that, the song We Belong by Pat Benatar. She earned a Grammy Award nomination for that song in 1985 for Best Pop Vocal Performance with We Belong. Good morning, I'm Veronica Rickert, and I'm glad to be here with you this morning. I'm in today for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Pat Benatar is one of the most iconic women in the rock world. She was the first female artist ever to be played on MTV. She played sold-out arena shows and produced 19 top 40 singles. Now, this leading lady of rock has published a memoir of her career, a firsthand account of a female artist thriving in a territory dominated by men, the rock and roll world of the 70s and 80s. Pat Benatar is our guest this morning. She, of course, is a four-time Grammy Award-winning singer who has sold more than 22 million records. Her memoir is called Between a Rock and a Hard Place, and I believe it was just published yesterday. And we're looking forward to taking your calls as well this morning. Were you a young woman who was inspired by Pat Benatar? Do you have a question about a favorite song? Well, you can give us a ring this morning at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234, or you can send your email to talk@wpr.org. And we'll see if Pat Benatar is with us. Pat, are you there? She is not with us yet. We're waiting. We're talking with her publicist, I guess, about some time zone confusion. Hope we'd have her by now, but we're hoping she will be calling any second. In the meantime, you know, we're thinking about all of the songs that she has recorded over the years that have really become rock and roll legends. We listened to one already. We Belong is one. You might remember some of the other ones from the 80s. Hell is for Children is one that she sang. That was a song that became a little controversial. There were protesters outside the arena. It became a song that was known now for speaking up for victims of child abuse. But at the time, there were some people who weren't quite sure how they felt about it. Another song you might remember is called Heartbreaker. That's the third single off her debut album. It was released in early December of 1979. And hey, if you want to throw us a lifeline this morning and talk about Pat Benatar before she gets here, we can take your calls and your questions. And hopefully she'll be joining us imminently. Again, I'm going to put out that number and you can give us a call and we can start talking about Pat Benatar. You might remember her and she might have been a part of your coming of age, your growing up experience. Anyway, our number, 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can send us an email at talk@wpr.org. And we have a caller on the line right now. Let's just go ahead and take a call. And hi, thanks for joining us. Caller, are you there? They are not there. And hopefully that wasn't Pat hanging up. But we're still waiting to hear from Pat Benatar. I guess in the meantime, we can also talk about programs you would like to hear. I think we've kind of gone as far as we can talking about Pat without her, without calls. Well, here's a couple lines coming in. Maybe someone will be talking about Pat Benatar there. I know that I, growing up, listened to a lot of her songs and didn't realize what a leading lady she was in the rock world, what a groundbreaker. And she was really singing and performing at a time when female artists were not the norm. I can remember one story from her book where she discusses the fact that, you know, radio stations would call her and say, you know, we'd like to play your single, but we're already playing another song by a female artist. So just because they had one other female artist, they were not playing her song. That's how hard it was to get airtime when you were a woman. And it looks like we have a caller now, which is great. So let's go to Patty from Milwaukee. Patty, thank you for calling.
Hi. I can't wait to listen to Pat and interested in her her book and her revelations about what it was like to be in the music industry at that time. But I'm just wondering, even though it seems like now there are more women obviously performing in the rock venue and other women artists out there that are very successful, I still feel I have a relative who's trying to make it in the business and still feel that it's still run by men. Men are managers, men are producers, men are in the music in the label business and what she thinks about all that when she comes on.
Okay, you know so, what, Patty? I have good news. She's here. And hopefully she's heard your call. But why don't you stay on the line just in case she hasn't. So thank you for calling, Patty. And Pat Benatar, thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me. How are you guys?
We're doing well. We started the show without you. Sorry about that.
I know, I'm calling from the cell phone, and some days it works, and some days it doesn't.
Yeah, we understand. Well, we're so glad you're with us right now. Thank you.
Thanks.
Well, we're taking a call right now, and Patty was kind enough to call in and share her memories and talking about a relative of hers who was trying to make it in the music business. Did you happen to hear any of Patty's call?
No, because I was trying to get through to you guys.
Sure. Well, Patty, why don't you come on again and just summarize your call again so you can actually talk to Pat?
Sure. I was wondering, Pat, even though now a lot of more women are able to be successful as performers in the business, I'm finding or I'm seeing that men are still running things behind the scenes. There's still so many more men managers, producers, label people. That all seems to be still so dominated by men. I wonder if you have any thoughts on that.
I'm not sure that it's any diabolical plan. I just think that men gravitate towards these jobs more. And I see, from my vantage point, I see a lot of women stepping up. And I work with mainly women all the time. I mean, Spider and I are together, obviously, but there's so many more women producers now, and certainly in publishing jobs and things like that, there are so many more women working, and it's really very refreshing.
Well, thank you so much for your call, Patty. And Pat Benatar, you know, when you started, you had a trained classical voice. How did you know you wanted to sing rock and roll?
I didn't. I was really, you know, I was just a typical teenager growing up, and even though I was studying and doing theatrical music and everything, for pleasure, I listened to pop music and rock and roll, and it never occurred to me ever to, sing that kind of music. I assumed I would always be a classical singer. My voice was really suited to it. I grew up in a really small town where there wasn't a lot of access to go see other kinds of bands. We lived really close to New York City, but, you know, my parents didn't let us go and do those kinds of things. So I never had access to that. So I just kind of went along with what was natural for my voice, but it was always inside. I always wanted to do it.
Well, right, and didn't you go to see Liza Minnelli, and you thought, you know what, I can do that?
Yeah, this happened later. I had moved from New York, and I had gotten married when I was really young, and the first time, and I was just working in a bank and going to Virginia Commonwealth University for voice, and I just went to the concert, and I hadn't been singing, you know, in any musical productions or anything for a long time, for about a year and a half, and I was just sitting there thinking, you know, what am I doing? I'm studying voice like to be a school teacher, and I'm, you know, working in a bank. This is crazy. And I just looked around in the Coliseum, in the Richmond Coliseum, and I thought, I could do this, you know. I talk about it in the book. I tell the story. And it really was the moment that the light went on, and I just quit my job the next day and started to go full force.
You were after this particular sound when you started singing, too. I mean, you had this very clear voice. And I think it was your husband, Spider, who sort of thought, well, that would work with the rock and roll sound you wanted. You wanted something harder. You wanted something that was guitar-driven. How did your voice, as a classical singer, how did you think about that translating to rock?
It was difficult in the beginning because I couldn't get, I mean, I knew what I had to do, but I couldn't seem to get the technique to give me the end product I was looking for. At first, it's a lot like Julie Andrews singing the Rolling Stones, you know, that kind of thing. it took a while, but, you know, I started to work with songwriters in New York, and once I started doing that, singing original songs, I found my voice. And certainly when Spider and I met and we put the band together, he was the catalyst, because what I needed was that heavy guitar sound to be the bed of what I was doing so that I could really push harder. Otherwise, it was kind of like screaming with no bottom. You know what I mean? So when he and I met and we instantly had, besides all of our, you know, chemical rapport and romantic rapport, musically, it was the perfect combination.
Well, let's talk about some of the songs that you're known for. One of the first, I guess, that broke away was Heartbreaker. Can you tell us about that one?
Yes, this is, people ask me if I have a favorite song out of, you know, the 31 years that we've been playing, and it's really difficult to choose one ever, because each of them have you know, some kind of sentimental value or some pivotal importance in your musical life. But Heartbreaker always is the one that I choose overall because it really summed up everything that I was trying to do. When we were given the song through Chrysalis, the lyrics were almost there, but a lot of it had, it was written by two English gentlemen, and it had a lot of colloquialisms in it that Americans wouldn't have understood. And so they gave it to me, and they said, can you rewrite the, you know, some of these verses and fix the chorus? And so I did, and it really had all the sentiment that I was trying to say, and certainly all the musical bombast that we were looking for. So it was the perfect vehicle for everything that we were trying to do.
All right, let's listen to a little bit. Oh, it's been a long time since I've heard that song. That's such a good song.
Thanks. I love to play it still.
You still love to play it? Do you and Spider sit around sometimes when you get bored on Saturday nights and bring out some of the old songs?
No, more like Louis Prima.
Well, it is interesting hearing your voice on that. Do you think you hear singers like you singing rock music today, especially women?
Say that one again?
I guess I'm wondering if a woman came along with your voice right now, would they succeed? It seems like such a unique take because you have this clear voice and this rock and roll sensibility.
I'm not sure. I mean, there's a lot of young women out there. I mean, it seems like it leans a little bit more towards the pop vein, but I'm sure that another incarnation of that kind of thing will come about. You know, I mean, it's you know, there's still women out there who you know, don't want to wear little cutesy dresses and bop around all day. You know, there's still some people out there that are, you know, kind of feeling the same way that I always was. So I'm sure that it will show itself again in some other form.
And you got your start at a place, I think it was called Catch a Star. Is that right?
Catch a Rising Star
in mm-hmm. New York, where you hung around with a lot of other people who were trying to build their careers. I think John Belushi was one of them. Mm-hmm. And you had a support group there, but that was really where you got discovered, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. I went, Catch a Rising Star was one of the leading clubs of the genre of those open mic clubs where comedians would go and work out material, and people would stand online during the afternoon, early in the afternoon, and get a number, and then you would get to perform in the evening in the order that you were on the line. So my number was 29, so I went on at 2:45 in the morning. But, you know, it was New York. It was still jammed, you know, and it was great. And I met Rick Newman, who owned the club, and he became my manager. And I told him what I wanted to do, and he really, you know, he was really shaking his head like, I'm not sure I understand, but okay. So we kind of just went about that, doing that, and basically singers were there to be filler between comedians. So it was a really, really fun time. It was one of the best times of my life because those guys were insane. I mean, you know, everyone that you could possibly think of that works today was there at Catch. I mean, you know, Robin Williams was there, Billy Crystal, Chevy Chase, Richard Belzer, everybody was there. So we had such fun, and, you know, and I was the only person who wasn't a comedian. So, so they mostly picked on me all the time, but we had a great time.
Say they used to like to time their jokes so you'd wind up squirting milk out of your nose?
Oh, absolutely. We'd go every night after we'd all play at Catch, we'd go. There was a restaurant on First Avenue called the Green Kitchen, and it was like a little more upscale coffee shop, and it was a coffee shop nonetheless. And we'd all go in there, and, you know, it'd be 4 o'clock in the morning. Everybody's starving. We'd be eating, and you know, they would all be laughing and doing their thing, but I was the only you know, non-comedic person there, so they would just wait until I was drinking coffee or eating eggs and whatever and just start. And, of course, it was, you know, they were having a grand old time torturing me.
Well, let's take one more phone call, and then we'll go to break. But let's first talk to Brad in Culver. Hi, Brad.
Oh, hi there. Hi, Pat. I was a big fan of yours in the 80s.
Thank you.
And a singer that I like a lot lately is Harriet Wheeler of a group called The Sundays.
Oh, yes.
You've heard of her.
I've heard of her, but I've never heard her music, but I've heard her name, yes. Tell me, what is it like?
Beautiful. Her voice is much like yours. It's very pure and pitch perfect.
Cool.
Great lyrics. And unfortunately, they only put out 3 bands in the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
But I think you could do some great covers of her material, actually. But I was wondering which singers you like to listen to. And also, I don't think you wrote the lyrics to your early tunes. And I wanted to confirm that, if the label took that responsibility more. And also, how do you preserve your voice when you're on tour all the time? I know Mariah Carey inhales steam. But how do singers do that so the vocal cords stay fresh?
Well, the biggest thing for me is sleep. I have to sleep when I'm on the road. It's really physically taxing. I always say that when we were making the records, all those anthemic songs that were so huge and difficult to sing, when they were balanced out between all those records, that was not a problem. But stringing them together for a live show, you're doing 14 of them in a row, it takes amazing physical stamina. So I really have to stay in excellent health and vocal health, and I have to sleep. And but nothing else. No, there's no other kind of babying my voice. I really just sleep, and I try. Not consuming a lot of alcohol or anything like that, it dries out your vocal cords. So, you kind of have to do clean living and take care of it like, it was the physical instrument that it is.
Well, it's time for our first break right now, and we'll come back and keep talking to Pat Benatar and taking more of your phone calls as well. We're talking, of course, with 4-time Grammy Award-winning singer Pat Benatar, who sold more than 22 million records. She has a new memoir out. It's called Between a Heart and a Rock Place. And our number to call this morning, 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. And our email is talk@wpr.org. I'm Veronica Rickert, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The song, of course, Hit Me With Your Best Shot, from Pat Benatar's second album called Crimes of Passion. Pat Benatar is our guest this morning, talking about her new memoir, Between a Heart and a Rock Place. And Pat Benatar, tell us a little bit about Hit Me With Your Best Shot.
This song came to us when we were rehearsing for the second record. And interestingly enough, Spider had received this song when he was with Rick Derringer. Spider played with Rick before me, and he was making the second record with him. And that's how Mike Chapman, who co-produced our first record, had met Spider. And so when the song was offered to us through the record company, Spider remembered receiving it the first time, and he thought that he could kind of edge it up a little bit. It's a pop song, straight and simple, and he just kind of, put that guitar on there and the sentiment was perfect. It just followed in line with what we were looking for or trying to say.
Well, let's take another phone call now. We've got Sean waiting to talk to you from Milwaukee. Hi, Sean.
Yeah, how you doing, Pat?
I'm good. How you doing?
Good. It's great to talk to you. Kind of like a hypothetical question, and this is, girls, teenagers that play music a bit, but knowing what you know now, if you were a parent and had aspiring youngsters, what advice would you give them, and how would you push them or not push them? And
I am a parent with aspiring youngsters. I have 2 daughters. The older one was interested in doing music when she was younger. She had a band called Glow. It was kind of a girl band, a girl group, and she's moved on from there. She's a jewelry designer now, but my youngest one, who's 16, is very interested in pursuing a musical career. So she's in theatrical music and concert choir, but she really wants to be she wants to do what we do. So, Spider and I are advising her every day. The most important thing is you must you must hone your skills. You have to be amazingly great at what you do. You have to, you know, have your stuff together and write songs if you can, and just get as much together as you possibly can before you go out there and show yourself, so that you have control over your image and what songs you're going to do, and etc. This is the most important part, that you go in as completed as you possibly can.
And you actually toured with your daughters, didn't you? They were there, and there's a...
They did. They did one tour with us, absolutely.
There's a funny story in your book about how one of your daughters became such a skilled traveler that she'd walk into the room, and she was, I think, four or something, and say, "I'm going to see if they have creme brulee."
I know. They're so funny because, you know, their whole entire life they've been traveling. I tell the story in the book that they've been out since they're infants, and I always took them always. I never toured without them, and they're just amazing. I mean, there isn't anything they don't know how to do when it comes to traveling, so it's great.
Is there anything in particular you tell a young woman, though, about being a woman in the music business, something to look out for, or maybe an attitude that you have to take when you're dealing, say, with record executives?
Well, it's interesting because, you know, having two young women for my children and all of their friends and everything, the thing that I see that has changed, I mean, it's not like sexism doesn't exist and people are still not doing things, but, you know, of course, it's different nowadays. There are laws. I mean, you can't do things and just get away with things anymore. But also, their attitude is different. They're miles ahead of where we began at. So when they begin, they're already in a different mindset. They expect to be respected. They demand it. And it's completely different from my point of view when I was their age. You know, I was kind of fighting for that position and you know, and not so much intimidated, but I was, you know, walking the line, questioning how far I could go, where, you know, what was the right thing. There was no rule book. And it seems to me that they have moved way ahead of that. They already begin with a different mindset of self-respect and expecting to be treated a certain way.
You give a lot of advice at the end of the book, and one of them is not to be afraid. Always
Definitely.
To go for it.
Definitely. I mean, I think that, you know, being intimidated or letting someone humiliate you and making you do things and or not being confident in yourself, it's the most important thing, I think. I think it's what saved me all those years. You know, I was just, you know, whether it was a smart thing, whether I was right all the time, which I was not, but I had such confidence in my own ability to decide what was good for me. You know, I tried not to be influenced by what other people thought was good for me. In my gut, I felt confident that I knew what was the right thing. And so, you know, you protect yourself. And I think it's really important for people to not turn a deaf ear to that. You know, listen to what you think is right for yourself.
Another phone call here we have with us, Daryl from Ixonia. Hi, Daryl.
How you doing?
Good. How are you?
I'm just a big fan. I really don't have a question. I just want to tell you I'm a big fan, and I listen to your music. I get your CDs. My daughter, who can listen to all my CDs, listens. She says, "I like Pat Benatar." She doesn't even know who we are. She's 13. But she's like,
That's great.
I like this
Thank
Pat
you.
Benatar. So, and I saw you on Good Morning America last year, and I stopped dead and just watched the TV, you know, freeze frame, and you know,
great.
Studying
Thanks.
You. And your husband is a guitarist, I think I've heard.
Yes,
and I've also
that's
heard
right.
like your vocal range is like that of an opera star. You can go totally, you know, low, high, more than, you know, an opera singer.
Yeah, all those lessons, it was a good thing.
I always thought my fantasy, if I ever met you, I figured I probably would faint. So,
well, don't do that.
I just wanted to, I'm just a big fan, and I got a 1,000-watt stereo in my car. I drive down the road cranking your tunes, and as far as girl bands, the only modern stuff I like is the Donnas. I think are really awesome, and they're kind of
Oh,
the same
they're great
flavor.
Girls, wonderful girls.
And I just wanted to say I'm a big fan.
Oh, thanks so much. Thanks for calling.
All right. Well, thank you for your call, Daryl. And how about Stephanie in Madison? Hi, Stephanie.
Hi. I'm just overjoyed to get to talk to Pat. I was laying in bed that last night. I couldn't sleep. I had all of Pat's songs running through my head. And oh God, the range of the music that you did. You know, there were so many great rock performers who are so, you know, exposed and loved all different types of music, and it really comes through. I just have to tell you, I just love your music. I was just so deeply touched by Hell Is for Children. That was one of the songs that, first time I heard it, it tore me up. But you know, I heard an interview with Jackie DeShannon on Fresh Air, and she was talking about, you know, there's this feeling being a woman in the music business, and she was talking about especially her close friendship and her partnership with Jack Nitzsche, producer Jack Nitzsche. And I'm thinking about you and your husband, who is such a phenomenal guitar player. What a wonderful partnership you guys have. You know, what a power pack you guys are, and how, you know, it's just, God, progress is sometimes you go a few steps forward, a few steps back, but you know, you inch forward. And I wanted just to comment on that, and also ask you, who are women singers that you admire?
Oh, I don't know this. I the gentleman that just called. We toured last summer. Deborah Harry and I co-headlined last year, and the Donnas were with us. And I can tell you, those girls are great. They're just they're everything that I had hoped would happen. You know, I mean, they get out there, they do their thing, and it's just a given to them. It's not even odd to be, you know, four high school friends out there, you know, traveling by themselves and doing the whole thing. I mean, it's so, you know, it's so like second nature. And that was what I was hoping when I was doing it, that it wouldn't be such a, you know, an oddity, and everyone would always, you know, gender base what we were doing. And it was great to see that. But I think there's a lot of women singers out today that are doing a great job. You know, there's so many, you know, the whole gamut. I mean, from, you know, Katy Perry to Lady Gaga to, you know, Sheryl Crow, who's my bud, and she's such a great singer. And, you know, I don't know, there's a lot of great people out there doing stuff.
And before we talk about Hell is for Children, let's listen to a little bit, because we have a clip here, and then you can tell us a little bit about that one. Here it is. And that was one of your songs that became a bit controversial, Pat. Tell us about what happened with Hell is for Children and where it came from.
You know, it was so crazy because, you know, the song we had been living in New York at the time, and it was in 1980, and a serial article was in the New York Times. It came out a few weekends in a row, and it was an expose about child abuse in America. And I grew up in this really small town on Long Island, and I had never heard about anything. I felt like I'd fell off a turnip truck. Where had I been? I had no idea this kind of thing was happening anywhere. And it just horrified me. And I really write lyrics and poems and things like that to kind of just get things out, you know. So I was writing these lyrics, and our bass player at the time, Roger Caffsey, came in, and he sat down, and we started writing things together. And then we got this, you know, this big kind of conglomeration of all these words, and I just thrust them at Spider, and I said, here, I don't know what to do with this. I mean, it was just like, you know, stream of consciousness writing. I said, take this, and, you know, I want you to really try and make this into a song. And he did. I mean, you know, he worked on it a little while, and he came back with that, you know, wailing guitar. And I really, it's so gut-wrenching. I mean, it really suited, you know, what we were trying to say with that song. And interestingly enough, when the song came out, there were a few groups of people that were protested outside of our concerts because we used the word hell. And obviously they never listened to the lyrics because, you know, everyone knows what the song is about. It's about the horrors of child abuse. And they just, the fact that we were saying hell is for children, you know, they were coming out and picketing the concerts. But thankfully it ended very quickly, because I think once everyone got an explanation of what the song was about, it ended. And over the years, it's been really gratifying to know that so many people hear the song. And, you know, they send us letters. I saw people, we were signing, I did a book signing last night in New Jersey, and all these people, they come up to you and they say, and they're adults, you know, and they say, you know, it was great to have someone, you know, say it out loud so someone could hear it. And that makes you feel great. I mean, you just always hope that it touches someone. It's not about writing songs just for yourself. So if you get to touch someone else with it, it makes everything worthwhile.
Well, thank you so much to Stephanie for her phone call. And we move to Tammy in Glidden. Hey, Tammy.
Well, hello. This is such an honor of mine.
Oh, thank you.
I just want to give you a couple, just two songs that are a memory, and then I got a question for you.
Sure.
Okay, when you came out with Help for Children, I was an abused child, and that's the only way I can explain to people how I feel. Mm-hmm. And even when I sing in karaoke, I got so much because what you put in that song is exactly what it feels like to be an abused child.
Oh, gosh.
And then Hit Me With Your Best Shot. We are a junior high pom-pom squad. We went with your song to a high school competition, state competition of over 1,500 kids. We came in fourth for
that's
junior
fantastic.
High. Now my question is,
yes,
were you the influence for JoJette and Lori Morgan? I remember seeing you sing with Lori Morgan and when she had Independence Day, which was another controversy, you know, about abuse.
Oh, you mean
women.
Martina McBride.
Yeah, that's who I mean.
Yes. And what was the question? I'm sorry?
They both ended up looking like you, too.
Oh.
They're like, okay. So
I always tease Martina that she's my younger sister.
Yeah.
She's a doll. Yeah, Joan is a great girl. And Martina's just the sweetest. She can be in such an amazing voice. And Joan is, of course, just the rocker extraordinaire that she always was. So, yeah, they're great women.
Do you think that you were an influence on either of those women?
Well, Martina says absolutely. We did Crossroads together. So she said that when she was growing up that she listened to our music and she wanted to be that. And she basically kind of does her country thing that she does, but she's always got that little edge in there, and she said that was because she listened to all of our songs all those years when she was growing up.
Okay, well, thank you to Tammy for that call. And moving on to Tom, joining us from Green Bay. Hi, Tom.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello, Pat. I seen you in Kansas with Huey Lewis and the News back in the 80s,
uh-huh.
And I seen you play in Oneida a couple years ago here in Wisconsin. But my question is, how did the videos change the music industry? Did you write the songs, then the videos, or do you think of a video, then write a song for it?
No, actually, I mean, video always comes second because the song really is the most important part of what you do. So we write the songs are recorded, and then someone comes in and, you know, and they want to do a video, and then you start talking about it because, you know, video is just another way to express what's happening in the song, but the song has to be there first.
And we have one of the songs that MTV aired in the second music video, I guess, that they aired by you. This is called
Yes.
You Better Run. You tell the story in your book about that first video, I guess, that MTV filmed, and the director came out and he wanted you to pose, and you said, no way, we don't pose. What happened that day?
Well, you know, this is such a new idea, and nobody really knew what they were doing, and I don't even think it was explained to us what this was going to be about. You know, they said, we're going to do this thing, we're going to shoot this thing called a video, you know, you're going to perform it. And up until that point, you know, all we'd ever done, we weren't actors, we were musicians, and, you know, you just play, you know, that's what we do. So the interesting thing is that video directors were sometimes film directors or commercial directors, and they were happy to be in this new endeavor that they could really have a no-holds-barred hand at shooting whatever they wanted for a very low budget, and they just wanted to go crazy. So when they came in, a lot of times they really had never seen you before. They had no idea what you did, and he came in, and I don't know what he thought we did, but he said, I'm going to turn on the fans, and, you know, I just want you to go. And I was like, what? I was like, have you ever seen us? You know, we were so, you know, edgy in the beginning and everything. And I said, no, absolutely not. And I was so angry, and they were just, you know, they were kind of intrusive. And I mean, it was only because I didn't know what was supposed to happen, and I wasn't prepared, and I just felt like, what do these people want? You know, and so the whole attitude of the video, which turned out to be perfect, was, you know, me being just angry the entire time at them intruding on what we were doing.
Hey, is the cover of your book from that video?
Yes, it is. It's a still from that.
It is.
Yes.
So it turned out pretty well.
Yeah, thanks.
That's a great picture.
Good job over there at HarperCollins.
Well, let's take our second break right now, and then we'll continue talking this morning with Pat Benatar, four-time Grammy Award-winning singer who sold more than 22 million records. Her new memoir is out. It's called Between a Heart and a Rock Place. And you can join us this morning and talk with Pat Benatar at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Veronica Rickert in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. That, of course, the song Love is a Battlefield by Pat Benatar, who is our guest this morning, four-time Grammy Award-winning singer. She's got a new memoir out. It's called Between a Heart and a Rock Place, and we're talking about that this morning and taking your calls at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. And we'll move now to John, who is joining us from La Crosse. Hi, John.
Hey, good morning. Hi, Pat.
Hi, John. Morning. How you doing?
I'm doing well. Say, Pat, I had the pleasure of meeting you about 98, 99. I was working at the La Crosse Civic Center when you did a show, and wanted to tell you that one of my fondest memories was having your young daughter just kind of ride through our concourse on a big wheel and just having a great old time. And that was just a really neat thing. I have two girls now, and I look back at that, and it's really cool. And coupled with that,
she's a big girl driving a car now.
Yeah, right. No kidding. And coupled with that, I had the opportunity to meet many acts over the time, and I wanted to compliment you. You're one of the most genuine and nice people that I had ever met.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And it brings me to a couple things. One thing, I was very surprised at how petite you are, and it makes me think of those early videos where my recollection is the video kind of made you look tall.
Yeah, it does. It makes people come in and they go, wow, you're kind of small.
And that makes me think, too, how booming the voice comes out of such a little lady. But in any event, along with those early videos, my question is, I guess, I'm wondering if kind of coming in as a woman at that time, an independent act, was there purpose to having some of your lyrics and songs kind of edgy and kind of sexy and woman in charge and that kind of thing?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the way that I grew up on Long Island, there's a really good anecdotal portion of the book in the beginning where, you know, it describes, you know, my family growing up, I mean, we were basically working class poor, and I lived in a neighborhood where it was mostly boys. And I wanted to, you know, play with them when I was little. And, you know, they in order to do that, because I was a girl, they would, whatever the initiation was for them to get in the club, they made it, you know, five times harder for me or more disgusting, you know, whatever it was, whatever kind of bug you had to eat, it had to be worse for me. So I don't know. I just kind of got to be a scrapper when I was little because, they were just constantly, you know, chasing me, torturing me. So it had so much to do with what happened later on. You know, it always stayed part of my personality. And when I decided to do this, to sing rock and roll, I really, you know, I was basically a product of the women's movement. And I just, you know, I just felt, I guess, what most women at that time were feeling, that they just wanted to step out, you know, and be strong. And that's what I did. So it worked great.
Well, thanks so much for your call, John. And how about an email? This one came in from Quinn in Oshkosh, who said, when I was living in a dorm during college, we loved to listen to Pat's song. She was our rock sister, and we were so fortunate to be able to say one of ours could rock just as well as the boy bands. Pat was the best, but I still have We Belong Together on my iPod and still consider her 80 songs some of my favorites. I plan to look for her book. Thanks for the rock, she says.
Oh, that's great. Thank you.
Did you get a lot of messages from young women who grew up with you and found it empowering to have a female up there, a woman, singing and rocking out?
I do, because, you know, like I said to John just a second ago, is that, you know, I
it wasn't, I'd like to take credit for being, you know, really smart and visionary on this, but I don't think that that was what was happening. I really think that I was just feeling what everybody else was feeling at the time. And I just had a forum, you know, to express that. And I think that people related to it. So I really think that the country was changing at that time. And I was just caught up in everything that was happening myself, you know, so I just got to, you know, portray that out in front of everybody, and they related.
Reading your book, it can seem like your career is pretty much storybook. You got discovered, you were a hit, you met your soulmate, and he just happened to be your guitar player. Things things went along pretty well for you, but there were some rough patches. And you talk about an episode when the album Wide Awake in Dreamland came out that wasn't so good for you.
No, I mean, there were, you know, the worst thing, I mean, luckily, you know, I'm so grateful that, you know, Spider and I have had a very idyllic personal life. You know, we get along great. We've been happy together. We have our children. Everything is great. We weren't drug addicts, you know, that kind of thing. But we did have a lot of issues with creativity and you know, constant confrontation with the record labels, because, you know, the music business was different then, and you know, they really thought that they were in charge, and they were, you know, always had their fingers in there trying to dictate to you about, you know, how music should be played, what you should be wearing. I mean, it was very intrusive, and it's not so much like that today, but those were the most difficult times, and they certainly had this one horrible practice that they had contractually, where they wanted you to make a record every 9 months. No one does that. And they never cut us any slack. And a lot of the times we weren't ready to make another record. And it was very frustrating, especially once I had children. I mean, they cut us absolutely no slack. They were like, okay, just slap that kid over there and, you know, get back in the studio. I mean, there was absolutely no compassion whatsoever. You know, we were struggling to figure out. It was kind of like Jumbo Shrimp. How do we do these two things to get a parent and be rock stars, you know? And no one really cared about that. They just were like, just, you know, get that record made. So it was very difficult in that way. But, you know, the rest of it was fantastic. We had a great time. It was thrilling and mostly fun.
Here's a call from Leo, who's joining us from Rhinelander. Hi, Leo.
Hi, I really enjoy your music, and there's very few singers other than, well, there's a girl named Nicole Case and a couple of them that seem to have that kind of a resonance in their voice like you do, and you've just been a real inspiration, everyone. I heard a song by you, I think it's called Somebody's Baby. It had like a perfect blend of sparkly guitars and your voice, where they both have kind of a natural echo, like the way a voice sounds in a church.
Mm-hmm.
My question is about the production, and if getting that sound right like that is an enjoyable part of what you do.
It is. I mean, this is basically Spider's job. This is what he does. He produces the records, and he goes in there, and you know, the two of us, we work on what it's going to be like, and, you know, what the treatment is, and then basically he's the one who goes in there and creates all that atmospheric stuff. I really stay out of that. That's entirely his thing that he loves to do, and I really want to concentrate on doing the vocals. So he goes in there and he makes all of that happen. You know, we duke it out for the keys and, you know, where the chorus goes, but the rest of that is all him.
I noticed that you're using the present tense. How much singing and recording and writing do you do together now?
I wish all the time. I mean, you know, that's what we do. So we're doing it all the time. And, you know, we tour every summer. And we leave on June 24th to start this tour for the summer for 56 cities. So, you know, we're constantly working all the time. And you know, it's great. He's right there. You know, we can do it in the kitchen.
Well, we had a question about Spider from Sean in Montella, who wonders how your husband got started guitar playing and who influenced him.
Spider started playing when he was about 7. His parents wanted both their children, his older sister, they wanted them to play instruments, and she played accordion, and his father's Sicilian, you know, Spider's half Sicilian, and so they wanted Spider to play accordion, and he said, no way. So they said, okay, how about guitar? So he got an acoustic guitar, and he and his sister would play on Sundays for their aunts and uncles, you know, all those great Italian songs. And then Spider's uncle, who is his mother's younger brother by 25 years, was only a few years older than Spider. And when he was about 11, his uncle bought him an amp and an electric guitar, and he plugged in, and then the rest was history. Once he knew that you could plug in a guitar and make it really loud, that's how it all began. And he was influenced. I mean, he was so left of center. I was, you know, kind of straddling the middle. And, you know, he played with the Dead Boys at one point, and, you know, he did all that crazy stuff on the left side of the spectrum. So he really had a lot of, different influences than I had. So the combination of us together, it seems crazy, but it actually works.
Well, I'm glad you took up guitar. I can't imagine your music with an accordion.
No. I know, imagine.
Yeah, I think you've had a very different career with an accordion backup. But it is interesting because he would tell you would push for more guitar sound, and he would say he really wanted it to be this dialogue between your voice and the guitar, this right. melodic handoff, which I think was pretty unusual for the time.
Exactly. Most guitar players are so egotistical, but he's a very conscientious player. He's really, the reason, I mean, he was born to produce because he's really a coach, and he sees the thing as a whole. It's not about him. So when he started doing production, I mean, it was really, you could see that this is what he really needed to do. So he made guitar playing take a second scene. I was like, no, wait just a second here, you know. I mean, I really love his playing, and he's not that I'm biased, which I am, but I mean, he's so underrated because he's such an amazing player, but he really always puts it second in the scheme of what we're doing. So I have to always stand there and, you know, pull it out of him. And he's like, no, let me go back. He's fiddling with knobs. And I'm like, put that guitar on you, you know, that kind of thing. So,
oh, well, let's take another phone call now. We have Dave with us from St. Francis. Welcome, Dave.
Welcome. Thank you. Hi, Pat.
Hi there. How are you?
I'm all right, Pat. Pat, I got to say, you're a cool chick. I remember when I was single during different periods of my life, you know, when I'd go in bars or clubs, and I would always play your songs on the jukebox, especially if I saw a woman I was interested in. Because I thought, if they can't, you know, get enthused and passionate with Pat Benatar playing, I don't want nothing to do with them.
That worked out for you, though.
You were very, very much a catalyst in my love life, so I had to say that.
Well, I'm glad it was a good thing.
It was a very good thing, and I still do it to this day.
Oh, that's great. That's great. That's so funny. I love that. Thank you.
All right.
So I hope that helped him get some good dates, the Pat Benatar litmus test.
You know, I tell you, I've been doing this for 31 years. You think you've heard everything. I love that.
Well, let's see. How about an email here? We're getting toward the end of the hour, but this comes from Patty in New Richmond, who says, what does Pat think of the use of her image in the 1980s? We all wanted to dress like her, and in the movie Fast Times at Ridgemont High, there were many Pat Benatars on campus. My favorite song is I'm Gonna Follow You, and it still gives me goosebumps. Thanks, Pat, for being such a great role model for us all. Can you comment a little bit about your signature look?
You know, it's really funny. I always say to my kids, you know, because if they want to, you know, especially the younger one who wants to go into the music business, I always tell her, make sure that whatever it is, you don't ever wear anything you hate or you're like questioning, because I promise you, you will make it into your thing for the rest of your day. So that look with that headband thing that I wore literally one time became this whole thing of this, you know, this outfit. And I was like, oh, please, I'm all the things to choose. So a lot of the times for me, it's very funny to look at these outfits that we wore. And I sometimes I look at them, what was I thinking? And of course my kids are mortified. They're like, Mom, did you wear that? And I said, yeah, pretty much everyone saw it too. So
you did have that. You wore those tights and a shirt over it in the beginning a lot, and you had the big,
exactly,
thick,
yeah,
coal black eye makeup on. That was quite a look. Yeah. I guess Liza Minnelli does that a little bit.
Oh,
that,
yeah,
kind of thing.
So I still do all that eyeliner in, and you know, even my kids, I think my kids could put, you know, perfect eyeliner on when they were five. You know, it was genetic.
Wow. The eyeliner thing. Do you feel like you're happy with your look? It was obviously, you know, it caught on. It worked for you. Or would you go back and do anything differently?
No, because, you know, I love the one thing about being part of an era is that if you nail it and it becomes, you know, iconic for that time. I mean, I love that. I love that it stays like encapsulated and, you know, in history that way. It's not, I'm not wearing it today. You know what I mean? So I love that it really was part of what was going on. And you know, that's great. It's like, you know, like Madonna's old, you know, layering of clothes that she used to wear. I mean, you love that because it was really what was happening right then. So I'm happy that it occurred, and I'm happy that it's not occurring now.
Well, Pat Benatar, it's been a joy to talk with you. Thank you so much for joining us. I have a feeling there's going to be a lot of people listening to Pat Benatar over the weekend.
Thanks, Veronica. Good talking to you.
All right. Thanks so much. Pat Benatar, a four-time Grammy Award-winning singer who sold more than 22 million records. Her memoir, Between a Rock and a Hard Place, was recently published. Like a copy? If you'd like a copy of this program, you can call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for program 616E. I want to thank Rhonda Fanning for on-air production and for producing this hour, and Rachel Owen for answering your phone calls. Hope you've enjoyed the music and the conversation this morning with Pat Benatar. I'm Veronica Rickert. I'm in this week for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.